Brother Trucker Book Club Podcast, Episode 26, Old Wars, New Tricks. This is Graham Bradley, and today we will delve into two excellent steampunk series that took historical wars and not only changed up the timeline and the world building, but also the technical elements thereof, and give us a fascinating insight into what might have been. Ready and... Okay, so the first series is by Cherie Priest, who is probably best known for this series, but she's written a bunch of other stuff too, including, I think, an urban fantasy series that I haven't yet tried. But the series that she wrote is called The Clockwork Century. And what she changed, aside from the steampunk elements, that is to say that there are advanced machines and bigger, stronger everything that the North had and the South had, she sets her story against the backdrop of a civil war that did not end in 1864. Actually, as the story is going on, it is in the 1880s and the war still rages. Now, each book in this series takes place in a different area of the United States and focuses on a different kind of machine, and for the most part focuses on entirely different characters, although some of the lesser characters overlap as the series unfolds. But the first book in this series is called Bone Shaker. If you take a look at the cover, you see a female face with aviation goggles on it, and reflected in one of the goggles is a massive blimp-like airship. You get the impression that it is an airship fantasy, and while airships do come into play, the eponymous Bone Shaker is actually an underground drill. It was devised by a man named Leviticus Blue, whose job was to take some investment money and try to build a machine that could dig through the Klondike up in Alaska. My brain wanted to say Antarctica, but no, it is not. It was Alaska. The idea was to see if it could find underground gold. But unfortunately, things went horribly, horribly wrong when he took it for a test drive in Seattle and ended up striking an underground vein of gas. They called it blight gas. And when it seeped up to the surface, anybody who came in contact with it was turned into a zombie. The book calls them rotters, but they're zombies. This drastically changed things in Seattle in this alternate 1880s. The city had to be walled off to contain the gas, and it took a massive hit to its economy and infrastructure, and a secondary economy had to pop up outside the walls, which seemed to focus largely on industries that purged the blight gas from the water source and from the air and stuff. Leviticus Blue's widow, Briar Wilkes, works at one of these water scrubbing plants, and she takes some heat for the fact that her late husband was responsible for screwing Seattle over and killing so many people. But she's making do until her teenage son Ezekiel sneaks into the city with a harebrained plan to try to clear his family's name and make things a little bit easier on himself. And so naturally, Briar, who still knows a lot about the city and the underground network of tunnels that her late husband dug, she's got to go into the city to try to save her son with nothing but an air mask and a couple of filters so that she doesn't get infected by the blight gas. It's an interesting story. It's a lot of fun. It's worth the process of discovery, so I don't want to give away too much more about the tech involved and things like that. I'll give you a brief rundown of the rest of the Clockwork Century series, though. On Amazon, there are 6 books listed, but there is actually a 7th that I know you can find the audiobook of on Audible. So in chronological order, the first is Bone Shaker, about a drill. The second is Clementine, about an airship, but that one's the one that's not listed. What it lists as the second is Dreadnought, which is about a train, although on the cover of the book there is a giant walker mech, which was also awesome, but it only appeared in one part of the book. The Dreadnought is a train that can cut through the wilds of Western America, and part of that book takes place even in Salt Lake City, where I currently make my home. The third book is called Ganymede, and that is based on an actual machine designed by a man named Hunley, who during the Civil War tried to build a crude prototype submarine. Obviously, in this slightly more advanced steampunk utopia that Cherie Priest has written, the submarine actually functions, and there's a cool mission around it. The fourth book, this is the one that I have not, excuse me, this is where I have not read the latter half of the series. The fourth book is called The Inexplicables, and we're back in Seattle for this one, from what I understand, and there are Sasquatches that have been turned by the blight gas, and so you get zombie Bigfoots. That was the big feet, excuse me. That was the tagline, the pull of this volume. Five is Fiddlehead. I think that's a big difference engine computer, old style machine. And then the last one is Jacaranda, which is some kind of hotel off of the coast of Texas on the island of Galveston. So I've read the first four books in this series, and I'm keen to keep reading them, but I did them mostly on audio, and I haven't seen the last four in that format, so I'll just have to check them out from my local library and catch up on them that way. But highly recommended. Trying to think of, in terms of content, probably a mild PG-13. You might have run into the occasional S-bomb, as far as I recall, but other than that, it's an interesting alternate look at what America would have been if you changed just a couple of things and drop in some cool tech and some really cool characters. So check that out. Bone Shaker by Cherie Priest. This fall of 2019 marks the 10-year anniversary of the release of Scott Westerfeld's diesel punk fiction masterpiece trilogy, Leviathan. It's one of those that kind of is very closely related to steampunk, but there are key differences once you start trying to over-categorize. I've mentioned this in a previous episode where you have different kinds of these quote-unquote punk genres, and diesel is different from steam only in the sense that the machines, you know, run on combustion engines of whatever kind. In this series, for example, they run on kerosene instead of steam power. But this is a retelling of World War I, you know, in much the same way that Clockwork Century is a retelling of events surrounding the Civil War. It does start out with a Prince Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary being murdered, but in real life, Franz Ferdinand had three children. In this story instead, he's given one named Alec, who is very quickly hunted by the prince's political foes and royal foes, as it were. And so a few loyalists sweep Alec away and say, hey, we're going to go grab one of our machines and go for the run in the woods. And you crack open the book, if you've got a physical copy of it, and you see these just delightful, beautiful pencil illustrations by Keith Thompson. And you see this big old massive armored chicken walker looking thing that Alec has actually experienced at piloting, despite the fact that he's 14, 15 years old as the series starts. So they've got to go on the run, and for the most part of the first book, he's running from similarly armored and armed Austro-Hungarians. Now, in the original World War I and World War II eras, we had, you know, the Axis on one side and the Allies on the other. In this one, the lines are drawn between what are called Darwinists and Clankers. The Germanic nations, the Teutonic nations, they tend to fall in the camp of being clankers, people that build big old mechanical monstrosities like the walkers that Alec and his camp use. The Darwinists build their technology out of living things. And to give you an idea of what that looks like, we travel north to the British Isles for our other viewpoint character, a Scottish girl named Darren Sharp. Because of the social mores of the time, she will never be allowed to fly, to be an aviator, like her father was, so she has to cut her hair short and disguise herself as a boy, change her name to Dylan, and join the Royal Air Navy. One thing leads to another. I won't ruin the process of discovery, but she ends up as a midshipman aboard the largest air vessel in the Royal Air Navy called the Leviathan. This is not your average, steel envelope, helium-powered airship that steampunk gives you. This is a genetically re-engineered whale, like the sea animal whale, that is engineered to breathe hydrogen, to fill itself with hydrogen so that it can float and become, you know, neutrally weighted in the air. And, it still has a gondola strapped to its underbelly the way that an airship would. And they have to worry about things like making sure that they don't take on too much weight, having ballast, and so on and so forth. Westerfeld, while making these huge technological leaps between the clanker tech and, you know, what genetic engineering actually could do in the early 1900s, he still tries to answer the overarching technical questions like, you know, how would you keep something like this afloat? How much could you actually take on? Just to try to give it some semblance of realism, to give it a set of rules to follow. Now, predictably, Darren and Alec have their paths cross for different reasons, and there are political ramifications to that, there are personal ramifications to that, and Darren has to keep her secret from absolutely everybody on board, but there are certain people who are not stupid, frankly, and you get the impression that they will figure it out. The first book wraps itself up pretty nicely, wraps up the original story, but definitely you won't get the entire arc of it without reading the whole trilogy, and it is very much worth it. This is not a story that wastes its time staring at the scenery of the world building. Getting an idea of what the world looks like and how it works is a seamless transition. It's definitely an easy part of the process of reading the narrative and the dialogue and seeing, okay, based on how they do this, this must work this way. It is also a bit of a globe-trotting trilogy. The first book starts out in Western Europe, and their paths converge in the Alps, and then they start sailing eastward. The second book takes place largely in Turkey in the Ottoman Empire. Westerfeld had to change up a lot of the details of the actual historical timeline to make them fit the compelling storyline that he wrote for all three of these books. For example, he had to move up the dates of certain revolutions that took place in Turkey and in the Ottoman Empire and who was behind them in order to fit what he needed his characters to do. But there still doesn't feel like any shoehorning. You know, there are definitely some, you know, there are definitely some bombs that were planted in the first book that go off in the second book, you know, emotionally speaking and characteristically speaking, that are such a delight to watch them go off. It's so great just to see how these events unfold and see how these characters tiptoe around each other, how they have secrets and what they decide to reveal to each other, at what point they decide to trust each other. And this is all against the very colorful backdrop of a very well-illustrated world. One of my favorite little tiny details of the second book, for example, is that when they land in Turkey, they have to go on a subaquatic mission, and midshipman Dylan Sharp, as she goes by, is recruited along with a couple of others to dive underwater with some diving suits made of living parts, you know, re-engineered from sea animals. And one of them is they call it a rebreather, and it's this nasty Cthulhu tentacle-looking thing that she's got to put in her mouth and let it reach down her lungs and basically give her a set of gills so that she can go diving under the water to inspect an obstruction that is in place for reasons that I don't want to detail because it would completely foil the plot. And then the third book is probably the most ambitious of them, but Westerfeld does a really good job of tying it all together and sticking the landing, and it takes them from Siberia to Japan, across the Pacific, to California, to Mexico, to New York, and you meet fantastic characters along the way. Nikola Tesla factors heavily into the third book. I can't praise it enough. I gave it 5 stars across the board, and noting that it's coming up on its 10-year anniversary, I'm probably due to go through the series for a third time. If you decide to go the audiobook route, that is also a worthy one, but you won't get the joy of the illustrations. But the audiobooks were narrated by Alan Cummings, who, if you saw GoldenEye, that Bond movie from the mid-90s, the first one with Pierce Brosnan, I am Boris, I am invincible. He was the hacker guy. But he just kills it with the accents on this. He's got to do Austrian and German, English and Scottish, American accents, Mexican accents. They run into Pancho Villa in Mexico in the third book, and he's got these big, massive, genetically engineered bulls that he rides around on. The Mexicans have these flying hang glider, well, not really hang glider, these air skiff things made of airborne manta rays. It's just, conceptually, at times it can seem so bent and so demented, but Westerfeld plays it off so well that it's just fascinating to think of. So I highly recommend Leviathan, and its sequels are called Behemoth and Goliath. I'm pretty sure that if you read the first one, you'll probably want to read the next two. And that's it for this week. I do apologize for not being able to get my wife in on this episode. We've just had a busy first couple of days this week, and I still wanted to release on time for Thursday. So I'll try to get her on for next week. I was going to talk about Brandon Sanderson's The Rhythmatist and have her talk about one of her favorite younger fantasy series. So we will get to that. Until then, I would like you all to drive safe, and I will see you out there.